gamer. With these deviant men, the more fantasy fun they are having, the more danger their fantasy partner is in. Therein lies the key. In these sorts of fantasies, the other person is depersonalized, made into an object. "I'm sorry to sound so cold about this," Ed Kemper apologized to me, "but what I needed to have was a particular experience with a person, and to possess them in the way I wanted to. I had to evict them from their human bodies." Once evicted from a body, however, a person cannot re-enter it. In other words, Kemper was saying that in order to have his sexual fantasies fulfilled, he had to kill his partner. Fantasies about sex are not discussed in families, even intact and functional families. Adolescent males are not routinely advised that now that they've reached puberty, it's okay to think about girls and nude bodies and doing things to females in bed. A child in a normal family, however, observes appropriate behavior between his parents, mom and dad hugging and kissing and holding hands. He accepts that his parents have a love relationship and expects that he, too, will have a similar one. Our murderers grew up without observing this sort of parental closeness and without feeling any affection directed toward them either. Normal people relate to sexual activity as part of loving. Deviants feel the sexual urge without having learned that it has anything to do with affection. And so they become boys who think about going out and getting it or getting laid without reference to the potential partner as an individual or even as a human being. Most deviants don't even know what they're going to do with a female when they get her. What psychologists call the cognitive mapping process is almost complete by this time. Cognitive mapping is the development of thinking patterns that affect how the person relates to himself and to his environment. It determines how the individual gives meaning to the events that happen in his world. He moves more and more into an antisocial position, viewing the world as a hostile place. He becomes almost incapable of interacting properly with the outside world because his thinking patterns are all turned inward, designed only to stimulate himself in an attempt to reduce tensions, which only reinforces his isolation. A loop is developed. The lonely teenager has aberrant fantasies and tries partially to live these out by tentative antisocial acts. The lie that is not found out, the cruelty to an animal, which does not have any ill effects on his own life, the fire that burns brightly, the frightening of a younger child that is not reported. He gets away with such acts. The effects of these accomplishments then become incorporated into his fantasies, which are pushed to a more intensively violent level. More retreat from society follows, and eventually, so do more experiments with actualizing the fantasies. In my interviews, I learned that the most difficult thing for murderers to discuss was the early expression of fantasy. Ed Kemper's fantasies began quite young. Yet, in our interview, he did not connect these with his first murders. At age 15, he shot and killed his grandparents. Probing, I learned that he did not connect these deaths with his grandparents' previous chastising of him for killing the birds and small animals on their farm, after which they had taken away his gun. Many children in rural areas are given guns, and they use them for hunting. But the creatures Kemper killed were not game animals. Kemper was angry at not being allowed to have the gun. There was a hidden agenda at that time, however, and his grandparents did not address it. Unfortunately, all that the grandparents did was remove his gun, believing that the absence of the killing tool would stop Kemper's bad behavior. They did not ask Kemper what was going on in his head, what his fantasies were, that made him want to use the gun to kill small animals just for the fun of it. I couldn't get him to talk about this directly, but I guessed that part of Kemper's reason for killing his grandparents was in order to keep his murderous fantasy from their view. What begins as fantasy ends as part of a homicidal ritual. A man who in childhood play pulled off the heads of his sister's Barbie dolls beheaded his victims when he reached adulthood. Another man ran around the yard as a child, chasing a friend with a hatchet. As an adult, he used a hatchet in his murders. John Jubert, at age 13, while riding a bicycle, drove a pencil into the back of a young girl. He found the act stimulating. When he was not caught or punished, he escalated his violence. Next time, while on his bike, he slashed someone with a razor blade. Going back into Jubert's life, we discovered that just prior to this first attack, he had lost a friend. He and a younger boy had started to develop a benign and possibly latent homosexual relationship. Then John went away for the summer and came back to learn that his friend had moved away. Jubert's mother said she didn't know where the friend had gone, and that John would just have to adjust to the loss. Another mother might well have helped her son locate a forwarding address, encouraged him to write to the friend, said they might be able to visit during the next vacation, and so on. Mrs. Jubert crushed the delight that her son had in this relationship, and soon after John jabbed the pencil into the back of the young girl. In doing so, he stepped over the line into actively criminal behavior. Once John Jubert's fantasies had pushed him to attacking another human being, very little could have prevented him from going on to later murders. Perhaps if he had been caught, punished, and actively counseled so that the stresses in his home environment could have been countered, he might have been deterred from further antisocial violence. But, and this is the sad thing, such actions were unlikely to quell the fantasies that drove the behavior. Though the home and social environments were non-nurturing ones, and seriously violent fantasies developed, many potential offenders still do not step over the line to commit violent acts. These young men are ticking bombs, waiting to go off, but their histories show that they are not pushed over into acts of great antisocial violence unless certain pre-crime stresses were present. In Jubert's case, it was the sudden removal of his only friend that precipitated his first attack. Later in his life, when he was in the Air Force, it was the removal by choice of his roommate at the air base, coupled with an unexpected and expensive repair that he had to have made to his car, that put him in the frame of mind in which he could make terribly real his fantasy to abduct and murder a young boy. The escalation of Monty Rissell's crimes from rape to murder came when he was back in high school after serving some time in juvenile institutions, and he was actually receiving psychiatric counseling as part of his probation. Before this, he had committed rape, but had not progressed beyond that to even greater violence. His girlfriend, a year ahead of him in high school, had graduated, gone on to college, and had sent him a Dear John letter saying that she preferred to spend time with other men. Rissell drove to the college and observed the woman with her new boyfriend, but he took no immediate action. Back at home near Washington, D.C., he sat in his car in a parking lot, had a beer, and smoked a joint, and thought about things until quite late at night. At around 2 in the morning, a woman appeared, alone in a car. She was a prostitute. There was no one around, and Rissell thought to himself that he would take from this woman, at gunpoint, what he could no longer obtain from his former girlfriend. With a .45 caliber pistol in his hand, he approached the prostitute's car and then abducted, raped, and killed the woman. Later, he went on to kill 4 more women. Richard Marquette's first murder was triggered by his inability to perform sexually with a woman he had picked up in a bar. Ted Bundy's first murder was supposedly precipitated by his loss of the financial support that had allowed him to go to law school. Some will argue that if Bundy had had no pre-crime stresses, had completed law school, and met a woman who satisfied a lot of his needs, he might never have murdered. He might have become a viciously aggressive lawyer, someone who visited prostitutes, sought sadomasochistic relationships, and otherwise tried to get rid of his anger. His deviance might have been more socially acceptable, and he might never have stepped completely over the line. We have no way of knowing that, of course, but judging from Bundy's later behavior, it seems more likely that he would have stepped over the line at some point, no matter whether he had stayed in law school or not, and no matter whether he found a woman who would satisfy some of his sexual fantasies or not. In his mind, he had long since fused sexual desire with the need to damage and destroy. David Berkowitz's troubles reached the boiling over point when he failed to convince his birth mother to make him part of her family. Of course, his wish to be part of that family was doomed to failure anyway. Ed Kemper, after coming out of prison for the murder of his grandparents, went back to live with his mother at her insistence. Yet, having fought to get him out of an institution, she then berated him steadily, saying that he was responsible for her dating problems. After one particularly harrowing argument with his mother, Kemper slammed the door, got into his car, drove away, and said to himself, "The first good-looking woman I see tonight is going to die." Then he went out searching for a likely victim, and soon found one, a woman on the college campus to whom he offered a ride home. Many of the pre-crime stresses that seem to precipitate murderous actions are the same as those that happen to lots of people every day. The loss of a job, the breakup of a relationship, money problems. Normal people cope with such problems and do so from a scaffolding of a helpful, normal pattern of development. In potential murderers, however, the scaffolding is faulty to begin with, and so are the mental mechanisms for dealing with the stressful events. Faced with a difficult happenstance, such as the loss of a job, they turn inward and focus on their own problems to the exclusion of all else, and on fantasies as the solution to the problems. A breakup with a girlfriend causes the man to be less attentive on the job, resulting in his getting fired. Now, without income and without solace, he encounters other problems, matters that earlier he might have handled in spite of pressures, but that now seem overwhelming. The pre-crime stress is the straw that breaks the camel's back. Crossing the line behavior is fundamentally self-destructive and socially destructive. It entails the offender doing things that he actually knows are wrong, and that will bring him untold grief if he is caught. Yet he is impelled to cross the line by everything that has previously occurred in his life. Only later, after many such acts, will he come to believe that he is invincible and will never be caught. Just before he edges to the line, the young man isn't so certain. Things have been building up to a point where the potential murderer is ready to commit his violent act. And then a possible victim appears, one who is in a particularly vulnerable position, and the potential murderer becomes an actual murderer. The deed is done. The threshold has been crossed, and there is no return possible. He's frightened, and he's thrilled. He has experienced a state of heightened arousal during the crime and liked it. He waits for several days, expecting arrest and punishment, but nothing happens. Perhaps the deed makes him feel badly, and he seeks to control his impulses. Bill Herons reported that he locked himself in a bathroom when he began to sense that he wanted to go out and commit a new crime, thereby hoping to prevent the feeling from overwhelming him. However, he managed to get out of the bathroom window in a bathrobe and do something heinous anyway. More usually, after the first murder, the man starts to feel more egocentric than ever, and becomes convinced that he can do it again with impunity. He incorporates details of the first murder into his fantasies and begins to construct future crimes. What if I toyed with her more before I strangled her? What if I dismembered the body so that the police wouldn't be able to identify the victim? What if I made the boy say and do certain things before I assaulted him physically? What if I took a ring from her so I could use it later in my fantasy replay of the crime? What if I looked for a victim in the next town rather than 5 blocks from my home? What if I prepared some restraints and took them with me so I wouldn't have to improvise at the scene? Used a gun to control the victim next time instead of a knife? Now that the first murder has occurred, in subsequent crimes, the life stresses that preceded the first one may not need to be present. Now that he's over the line, the murderer usually and more conspicuously plans his future crimes. The first one may have had some of the earmarks of spontaneity. The next victim will, in all likelihood, be more carefully sought out, the murder more expertly done, and displaying more violence to the victim than was evident in the first crime. And the lonely boy from the non-nurturing home has become a serial killer. 5. Death of a Newsboy. In the fall of 1983, I was on my way to my alma mater, Michigan State University, to teach at an annual homicide seminar. It was a warm September day at Michigan State. The leaves were turning color and the campus looked beautiful. When I walked into my hotel, I was handed a message to phone the office immediately. Any time I get a message like that, a chill goes through me, because I know something rotten has happened. Bad news travels fast, especially if you're a law enforcement officer. I called in, and my immediate superior told me that a young newsboy named Danny Joe Eberle had been abducted and murdered in Bellevue, Nebraska, near Omaha, and that I should go to Omaha and see what I could do to help find the killer. I leapt at the chance. My mind flashed to two similar cases. Almost precisely a year earlier in Des Moines, a young newsboy had vanished under eerily parallel circumstances, on a Sunday morning while delivering his papers. Newsboy Johnny Gosch had never been found. The FBI had been slow to get into the Gosch case, and Mr. and Mrs. Gosch had both told me personally that they were very bitter about that. Of course, the abduction of their son had been done within a state's borders, and the FBI technically had no jurisdiction, but they quite legitimately felt that the nation's premier law enforcement entity ought to have done more. Similarly, and earlier in time, when young Adam Walsh had disappeared, the Florida police had asked the FBI to get involved in the case, and the Bureau had declined, saying it was a local matter, and unless there was some indication of interstate travel, we had no jurisdiction. Later, when Adam's head was found floating in a canal, and there was a suspect who had an out-of-state car, the FBI took an interest. John Walsh, Adam's father, rejected the Bureau's help at that time. He later told me his reasoning. The Bureau hadn't wanted to assist when the case was just a missing child, but agreed to participate only when the boy's head was found and the child's life was clearly beyond saving. The Walshes could do without that kind of help, he said. John Walsh later went on to national prominence as the host of the syndicated television program America's Most Wanted. I had agreed with both the Gosches and John Walsh that the Bureau should have been involved in the searches for their sons and ought to be more aggressively and earlier involved in such cases of missing children in the future. The problem had always been that lack of jurisdiction. When I went through the FBI Academy as a student, we had learned about the various federal laws that we were to enforce. One of them, for instance, was the Migratory Bird Act, which we called the Blue Heron Law. It was a federal crime to kill certain migratory birds. Another federal crime was not removing the door from a refrigerator when it had been put on the street for pickup by the garbage department. Both these laws, by the way, had been introduced after problems had been discerned. The bird law was passed to protect a species that was fast disappearing because it was one of the favorite sources for plumes on ladies' hats in the early part of the 20th century, and the refrigerator door law had been passed after a startling number of children had climbed into abandoned refrigerators and died because they were unable to reopen the doors. None of the federal laws involved serial murder, and the definition of kidnapping was such that the FBI could enter the case only if there was a ransom note or demand. The Walsh and Gosch tragedies, together with the urgings of child advocates throughout the country, had helped alter the climate of opinion in Washington and in state capitals toward missing and abducted children. In an omnibus crime bill introduced into Congress in the early 1980s, the Reagan administration pressed to have murders, kidnappings, and other serious crimes become a part of the FBI's jurisdiction. This bill had recently become law when Danny Joe Eberle was abducted, and so there was a determination up and down the Bureau to assist in the case in whatever way possible. As soon as Danny Joe had been reported missing, the special agent in charge, SAC, of the Omaha FBI office had sent his deputy, Johnny Evans, to the nearby small town of Bellevue to see what he could do, and then sought permission for Evans to stay on until it was solved. Evans was an upstanding guy, the very model of a good FBI agent. Clean-cut, handsome, civic-minded, just the sort of man to help convey the wish of the FBI to throw the organization into a difficult case. Johnny Evans became extremely involved, determined to see the case through, and he worked closely with local, state, and military authorities in a coordinated effort that was unique at the time. It was when the boy's body was found, 2.5 days after the abduction, that I was asked to get into the case. This was one of the first times I would actually be able to go on scene in the midst of a murder case. It was a chance to see things firsthand, and to have more give and take with local authorities than the telephone and teletype usually allowed. Out of the classroom, onto the front lines. I certainly wanted to be involved, and my superiors wanted me to, because we both thought we might be able to render some real help. At higher levels in the FBI, I think that the decision to have the Bureau participate fully in the Eberle matter was political, to make sure that the Bureau had a presence in this first important missing child case to arise after the new law had been passed. It was a good thing, too, because there was a crying need for the sort of services that the Bureau could render in the areas of added manpower, the VICAP system that we were still developing, our growing expertise at profiling, and our traditionally superb laboratory work. It was snowing in Omaha, and I had no coat, having been prepared only for the balmy Michigan state weather. I shivered as I was picked up at the airport by Sarpy County Sheriff Pat Thomas and driven to Bellevue Police Headquarters. The task force was already established and at work. Dozens of people were collecting and trying to analyze information. Johnny Evans was glad to see me. Although a veteran agent, he had worked mostly on such things as organized crime, bank robberies, and interstate commerce problems, and had no experience with a murder, especially one as stomach-turning as the killing of this young newsboy. Bellevue is an outlying suburb of a typically Midwestern city, a place of modest incomes, quiet and orderly. The sort of place you think of when describing the good quality of life that the United States symbolizes in this world. Before dawn on a Sunday morning, Danny Joe Eberle had awakened, dressed, all except his shoes, for he liked to travel barefoot, despite his parents' reminders, and taken his bicycle down to a local convenience store where he picked up papers to fold and deliver on a regular route. Danny was 13, a blondish, bright-eyed boy, 5'2" and weighing 100 pounds, the son of a post office employee. His slightly older brother also had a paper route. At 7 that morning, Danny's newspaper route supervisor began getting calls from neighborhood patrons saying that their papers hadn't been delivered. He went to check, found nothing, and then roused Mr. Eberle, who also searched the area and did not find Danny. The first 3 papers had been delivered, but Danny's bike lay propped next to a fence near what should have been the 4th delivery site. The remaining newspapers were still in the bag, and there was no sign of a struggle. Danny had just vanished. The police were contacted, and they called the FBI's Omaha office. There was some suspicion that Danny might have accompanied his aunt and uncle on a trip out of state, where his uncle was going to look for employment. That notion was quickly disproved. A massive building-to-building search of the area was begun, and on Wednesday afternoon, Danny's dead body was found in some high grass alongside a gravel road, 4 miles from the site where his bike had been found, and only a few miles from the Iowa state line. I went out to see the place where the body had been found. There are lots of things you can tell from crime scene photos, but being on site has a distinct advantage. You are able to be completely oriented, to see relationships between details that you might otherwise never figure out. For instance, it was easy to see that the site was near to a gravel road and a dead end. What might not have been obvious from crime scene photos unless they had been taken of the quarter mile or so around the site of finding the body, however, was the existence of a crossroads nearby with one of the roads leading to a river. Why hadn't the killer or killers put the body into the river where it might have floated away or been more concealed? The site was the sort of area where people had outdoor parties, jettisoned beer cans and such. There were tall weeds growing alongside the road, but the site was actually visible from the road if one happened to be looking carefully. Someone dumping the body there would have had to worry about a passing car's headlights silhouetting him, if it had been still dark or otherwise courting discovery. The public had been told that Danny Joe Eberle had been killed with a knife. The details were far more horrible, for the newsboy had been mutilated as well as killed. The body had lain as if he had fallen or been dumped in the weeds, face down, hands and feet tied behind his back with rope. His hands, feet, and mouth had also been taped with surgical tape, and he was stripped to his undershorts. There were multiple stab wounds in the chest and back. The neck had been slashed. It appeared as if a slice had been taken off the shoulder, and on the left calf there were post-mortem wounds that seemed to be in a crisscross or tic-tac-toe pattern. There was some facial battery and pebble indentations all over the body. The medical examiner's report suggested the body had been moved perhaps more than once after death because of a pebble found in the victim's mouth under the tape, and also suggested that Danny might have been kept alive for as much as a day after capture and killed close to the time that the body was found. There had been no sexual assault on the body in any way, nor had the underpants been removed. Being on the scene and talking to the various officers and witnesses and the like was quite important to my understanding of the case. Danny Joe's older brother reported having been followed by a young white man in a tan car on his own route a few times. There were other witnesses who couldn't provide many details, but did believe they had seen a man in a car seemingly trailing other teenaged boys from time to time. I took all of this information into account and wrote up a preliminary profile. In the profile, I said that Danny Joe Eberle's killer was a youthful white male in his late teens or early 20s. As the listener now knows, most serial killers are white males, and this was a white neighborhood. Any black, Hispanic, or even Asian man entering the area would most probably have been noticed. I thought the killer was young because of the tentative nature of the killing and because the body had been dumped not far off a road, indicating that this was the first time the killer had killed. Of course, he couldn't be too young because he or his friends had to have a driver's license, but the killer did not display the savvy of a man in his 30s. I thought it possible that the killer was someone who knew Danny on a casual basis, at least well enough so that he might have been able to approach the newsboy and induce him to voluntarily enter a vehicle, a car, or possibly a van. I wasn't sure whether there was one killer or several. The violent male might have been accompanied by one or two other young white males, I reasoned. Perhaps one lured the boy into the back of a van, where the other controlled him while the first drove away. Based on what I knew of the victim, I thought there was a possibility there had been an attempted sexual assault on Eberle that he had resisted, and that he had been killed while resisting, although there were no defensive wounds on the body. The way the body had been abandoned on the remote roadside suggested to me that the killer might have panicked after the killing and had hurriedly gotten rid of the body rather than dispose of it in a more orderly manner. The dumping of the body just off a lightly traveled road suggests that the killer may not have possessed sufficient strength to carry the body further into a wooded area, I wrote. I believed the unknown suspect was somewhat aware of the location and had probably traversed the area many times previously. The ligatures and lack of abrasions under the ropes, together with the pathologist's report, had convinced me that the victim might have remained unbound for a while and could even have been treated well for a time before being killed. Returning to the precise identity of the killer, I stated that he was from the local area, not a stranger or a transient who happened to be passing through, and that he was single and not educated beyond the high school level. He might be unemployed or employed in a rather menial or unskilled capacity. The crime showed a certain level of intelligence, but not enough intelligence for every aspect of the killing to have been pre-planned, and that was why I thought the killer hadn't gone beyond high school. Yet the binding and rope tying suggested that this was a person who worked well with his hands. After considering the nature of the wounds, the tape, the rope bindings, the most important fact was that there had been no actual sexual penetration. This almost always means a youngish man who has had no true sexual experience with a consenting peer, either male or female. Since that is unusual in our society, it also connotes psychological problems while growing up. Here was a killer who stripped the boy down to his underpants, but did nothing more. I wrote of the killer's probable psychological orientation. The main perpetrator would definitely have had a chronic sexual problem, indicating deviance and bizarre sexual experiences throughout his life. Having reviewed many cases in which the killers did not penetrate their victims but did mutilate them, I knew that behavior of the level of a mutilation murder does not happen without a lot of deviant fantasies paving the way. Fantasies that would have had to surface in one way or another in earlier years. My profile continued, "He would likely be an avid reader of pornography, and may have been involved in experiments of a bizarre nature throughout his adolescence. This experimentation could involve animals and possibly forced sexual acts on younger children, both male and female." As the listener now knows from Chapter 4, this sort of earlier behavior is often associated with those who grow up to murder. There is one apparent contradiction here. I knew that the victim had not been penetrated, but I thought it possible that the killer might have earlier been involved in forced sexual acts with younger children. It was possible that he had been reluctant to penetrate because of the presence of other people in the car or van. The profile went on. Indications are that the killer would have been involved in recent stressful events in his life, which might include breaking up with a girlfriend, losing a job, being dropped from school, or trouble with his immediate family. As the listener also knows, such pre-crime stresses are usually involved in first murders, and I thought this to be a first murder. Further, I wrote, the individual may have been absent from his employment, if employed, for several days before and after the disappearance of Eberle. This last characteristic I suggested because of my interviews with murderers. Many, such as Berkowitz, told me that the time right around the murder was quite important to them, so important that they had absented themselves from their usual routine before and after it. I knew that the killer had been out at 6 in the morning, which indicated that he had no one to whom he was responsible, and therefore was most likely not living with a wife or with overly concerned parents. Sometimes when there is a case that occurs at this early morning hour, it's the result of a killer who has been up all night, drinking, to raise his courage to the point where he can do the crime. If he had kept the child alive for some time, he must have had a place in which to do so. I was not certain why the victim had been found in only his underwear, because there could have been reasons other than sexual for keeping him that way, to prevent him from running away, for instance. I had the distinct impression from the gravity and incompleteness of the wounds that the killer had murdered the boy somewhat spontaneously, and then, after death, had cut the victim on the back of the neck, thinking perhaps that he would decapitate him and dismember the body and scatter the parts, but then pulling back because this was hard to do, and just leaving the body somewhere that seemed remote. This indicated to me that he had never before dismembered a body, but suggested that he might have killed before. There was one aspect of the body that I thought might be important, but I wasn't yet certain about it. On the leg and shoulder there were some wounds that seemed inexplicable. Why would a killer cut away a portion of the shoulder or the flesh on the inside of a leg? In the back of my mind, I thought it possible that these slices had been done in an attempt to obliterate bite marks on those parts of the body, but I couldn't yet prove my contention. Biting in a sexual frenzy was consistent with a killing that had a sexual basis, as I believed this one did. Because of the killer's lack of control, as demonstrated by the crime scene, I thought it probable that he might inject himself into the investigation, trying to appear helpful but actually seeking information by hanging around the fringes of the dump area, the mortuary or gravesite, or the neighborhood in which the crime was committed. Considering such a possibility likely, I suggested that any artist's conceptions of the killer that were produced on the basis of witnesses' recollections should not be made public, but should be kept within the law enforcement community, in case the killer showed his face anywhere near the investigation. For some time, we had people watching the funeral, the gravesite, the place where the body had been found, and the location where Eberle had been abducted, but with no luck. In addition to the profile, I did what we might call a preliminary VICAP analysis. Using the computer in my head, rather than the one at Quantico, I compared this case to others and concluded that it was not that similar to the Gosch case. Eberle's body had been found. Gosch's was still missing. Gosch's abductor, it seemed to me, had taken far more care than the killer of Danny Joe Eberle. The media continued to play up the fact that both victims had been newsboys, abducted on Sunday mornings. I, knowing more details and having more experience in comparing crimes, did not think the same abductor had been at work in both cases. The rope used in the binding of Eberle was sent to our laboratories for analysis, but it did not match any known samples. That, in itself, was an important clue, for the uniqueness of the rope might help in pinning the crime on someone who had other pieces of similar rope. In addition to providing laboratory work, the FBI wanted to put every asset in our arsenal at the disposal of the investigation. And so our hypnosis team from San Antonio was called in to assist. The older Eberle boy and other witnesses agreed to be hypnotized in order to recall what they had seen. Very little extra evidence was gleaned from them, but every bit added to our understanding of the probable killer. Despite my strong belief, seconded by Johnny Evans, that the person who had abducted and killed Eberle would strike again, there was nothing more that I could do on the scene, and so I returned to Quantico. The task force was doing all that could be done. The Eberle family was bearing up reasonably well, aided by their faith and the close support of their neighbors and fellow parishioners. I had a teenaged son of my own at home and felt the family's loss keenly. I was in Alabama at yet another road school in early December when I received a second call directly from a distraught Johnny Evans. Another boy had been abducted near Omaha and found brutally murdered 3 days later. Our worst fears had been realized. I rushed to Omaha once more without benefit of an overcoat and was soon wading through the snow with Thomas Evans and many of the same people whose acquaintance I had made in September. At around 8:30 Friday morning, December 2nd, young Christopher Paul Walden, the son of an officer at Offutt Air Force Base, had been walking to school in Sarpy County and was last seen getting into a car with a white male. 3 days later in the afternoon, Walden's body was found by two bird hunters in a heavily wooded area 5 miles from the abduction site. He, too, was wearing only his undershorts and had been stabbed and had his throat slashed so far that he was nearly decapitated. There was no question in the minds of any of the law enforcement people who viewed the damage done to the Walden boy that the killer was the same person who had similarly savaged and mutilated Eberle's body. The pattern of post-mortem wounds on the second victim indicated that the killer was escalating his sadistic slashing of the victims. Christopher Walden had been the same height and age as young Eberle, but 15 pounds lighter. It was fortunate that the second victim was found just then, for a heavy snowfall had recently begun. Another few hours of snow would have completely covered the body and the tracks near it, making it highly unlikely that the body would have been located before the spring thaw. At that point, several other murders might have already occurred, and the clues to this one might have been degraded and no longer helpful. In many cases, the scene where the abduction takes place is not the death scene, and the death scene may not be where the body is eventually found. That latter site is referred to as the crime scene and invariably yields the most evidence. The abduction and murder sites may never be found. Victims are lured away from abduction scenes, and bodies are transported even farther in attempts to stave off discovery of the murder and any possible connection of the killer to the murdered person. Eberle had been killed somewhere else and his body dumped in the weeds near the river. This second victim was found many yards into the woods, but it seemed that the dump site was also the place where he had been murdered. Prints beside the body, almost covered by the snow, showed clearly that two sets of feet had walked to this site, and only one set had walked out. Walden's clothes were piled neatly next to him. Clearly, he had been killed here. That in itself was an important clue, for it told me there was only one killer, and that he had been relatively slight of build. He had evidently forced Walden to walk into the woods where the murder was committed. To my mind, the killer was an obvious coward. These teenaged boys were low-risk victims for him, akin to little old ladies. Vulnerable victims, too young or too scared to resist someone who might be a few years older but not that much larger than they were. On the other hand, I had to recognize and take into account that this was an offender who had improved his M.O. since the first murder. I tried to get into the murderer's mind and think as he had done. Let me attempt to replicate some of that thinking here. The first one, I brought the props with me, the tape and the rope. Maybe they've sent such things to the FBI laboratory to be analyzed. I won't use them again. I don't need them anyhow because I've learned that I can control the victim through ruses, through mental pressure and threats. Maybe what I should do is take the kid a little farther into the wooded area. I certainly don't want the kid's clothing left in my car where I left it the last time, so I'll have him walk in clothed, then disrobe, and then I'll kill him. Such a level of planning on the killer's part led me to revise my estimate of the killer's age. I thought now that he must be in his 20s, not in his teens. The stripping of the child now stood out boldly as a sexual matter, not as a control action. That, combined with the lack of sexual penetration, now verified by a second instance, made me firm up my belief that the killer was asexual. I would have been surprised if he'd ever had a consenting sexual experience with a female, and if he had had a homosexual experience, it probably had occurred when he was about the same age as these victims had been. He would have difficulty associating with people in his own age group, though he might date because he was attempting to deny his homosexuality. If he did date, it would be significantly younger girls whom he could easily dominate. What we were seeing in these two murders was a killer's anger at himself, expressed as homicidal rage toward victims who, in his mind, mirrored the boy he had been at their age. In his everyday life, this killer didn't have a lot to say about his existence, about what happened to him, and when it happened, and how it happened. He might or might not be physically weak, but he was, beyond doubt, emotionally weak. That was why I concluded that this second killing had been a different event from his first one. The first time, it had been an experiment. The second time the killer had demonstrated his fascination with the taking of a human life and had tested and proved to himself his power and control over the victim. For example, the cutting in the second murder had been more extensive than in the first. The post-mortem cutting indicated to me a growing morbid interest in sadistic activity that I thought might come to dominate the killer's behavior in his future murders. In between the first and second murders, one clue was actually discovered not to be a clue. The pebble in the mouth, which at first had seemed evidence that the body had been moved from elsewhere, turned out to be a mistake. The medical examiner had originally stated that a pebble had been found in Eberle's mouth. Later, the ME retracted this statement and explained that the pebble was from another case and had nothing to do with the Eberle murder. The absence of the pebble allowed us to speculate that the first murder had taken place closer to the time that the body was found. I revised my earlier profile. There was only one young male killer, I now wrote, a single killer with no accomplices. Thinking of his ability to carry the body, I wrote that he would not be much larger than his victims, and that he had killed on sight in order to avoid lugging the body any distance. I thought it certain that the killer lived in Bellevue, or on the airbase. He was just too familiar with the area to be from anywhere else. In fact, I was leaning heavily toward believing that the killer had to be on the base. Staking a position quite far out on a limb, but commensurate with my earlier guesses about his intelligence and education, I said that the killer would most likely be a low-ranking airman, E-4 or lower. He would not be highly skilled, not someone who worked with computers, but a man who worked in administration or light maintenance, probably some sort of a mechanic. Leaning on the evidence of the wounds, which showed attempts to conceal signs of bite marks, I wrote that I felt the killer would be a reader of detective or police magazines where the ability to identify someone through bite marks is routinely discussed. The pattern of the wounds and the ease with which the killer had abducted both victims were the items that concerned me when I stated that I felt it likely that the killer would be involved with young boys in some way, Boy Scouts, Little League, or some other kind of coaching. I was entirely convinced that the killer would strike again, and soon, because school holidays were coming up. So was Johnny Evans. We talked over the details. Now the children would be out in their yards or on the streets and in the open playgrounds at all daylight hours, and the killer could approach one at any time. I recommended an all-out media blitz, utilizing the newspapers, television, and radio, to caution children to play in groups, not alone, and to advise parents and guardians to look for suspicious cars and persons, and, when they saw anything suspicious, to write down license plates and descriptions and such, and to phone them in to the number of the task force headquarters, which would be heavily advertised. The task force also put together what they called a Code 17. In the event of another abduction being reported, the entire Sarpy County area could be sealed off within 11 minutes. It was hoped that this way, if there was another child snatched off the streets, the abductor could be apprehended before he took the victim into the woods to be killed. The media blitz was tremendous, and so was the cooperation from the public. Perhaps as a consequence, there were no killings for the remainder of the year. At home again for the holidays, I rested a bit easier. During this period, the local authorities picked up many known sexual deviants and interrogated them quite thoroughly. One was a prime suspect in the murders. He even flunked a lie detector test, and rope and surgical tape found in his residence seemed quite suspicious. He fit the profile in many regards, though he was openly and overtly homosexual. He passed the second lie detector test and in other ways proved not to be the murderer, however. The community was surprised by the number of people whose deviant behavior was so noticeable that it had become of interest to the police, and a half dozen of the worst offenders, such as a pedophile who used to pull young boys into his Cadillac, were arrested and convicted on various charges during the manhunt for the killer of Eberle and Walden. In addition, a witness who had seen Walden and a young male walking together just prior to the abduction was hypnotized, and under hypnosis managed to recall that the two walkers seemed about the same size. She even came up with the first several digits on the license plate of the car toward which they had been walking. Because of the high degree of coordination among the law enforcement authorities, this number was quickly given to the state's Department of Motor Vehicles and a computer run made. There were nearly 1,000 cars in the state that had those first several digits on the plates, but many fewer than that in the Sarpy County area. The police were about to start checking every single car on the list when early on the morning of January 11, 1985, they got a break. A female teacher at a church daycare center noticed a man in a car who seemed to be hanging around the center, a slight young man who matched the partial description that had been given out through the media. The car didn't match, but the driver did. The young man saw her writing something, parked the car, and knocked on the door of the center, then pushed his way in and asked to use the telephone. She refused to let him do that. He threatened to kill her and told her to give him a slip of paper on which she had written down the license number of his car. She managed to run past him into another church building and to call the police. The man fled in the car. It was 8:30 in the morning. With the license plate number in hand, the police were quickly able to find the owner of the vehicle, a nearby Chevrolet dealership. Rushing there, they learned that the car the teacher had seen was on loan to an airman at Offutt whose own car was being repaired. The airman's own car in the dealer's garage matched the description provided by several witnesses, and its license plate had the same first digits as those recalled by the woman who had undergone hypnosis. Peeking in, police saw some rope and a knife. Proceeding with extreme caution, the police obtained a search warrant before entering the car. Later, it was learned that this car was the fourth one on the list of 1,000 that had been spewed out by the DMV's computer, and it would most likely have been investigated anyhow within the next few days by a planned search for those vehicles. Even before thoroughly searching the car, the police alerted the airbase, and in the company of an FBI agent, a Sarpy County lieutenant, and several agents of the Air Force's OSI, Office of Special Investigations, went immediately to the quarters of A1C, E3, John Joseph Joubert IV, a radar technician involved in maintenance work. Joubert agreed to a search of his quarters. The investigators found more rope inside a duffel bag. Also, there were a hunting knife and 24 detective magazines. One of those magazines appeared to be particularly dog-eared and well-thumbed, and it contained a story about the killing of a newsboy. Baby-faced, 21 years old and slight, 5'6 and 164 pounds, Joubert fit the profile to a T, down to the fact that he was an assistant scoutmaster of a local troop. Joubert was interrogated for many hours by several teams of officers. He denied the offenses at first and said all the evidence was circumstantial and would never convict him. When confronted with the fact that the rope in his duffel and car appeared to match that taken from the first victim, and told that it was a very rare rope that the head scoutmaster of the troop had brought back with him from Korea, Joubert asked to talk to the scoutmaster and to one 14-year-old scout to whom he had been quite close. Those people did talk to him, and shortly before midnight on January 11th, Joubert confessed to killing the two boys, citing details that only the true killer could have known. I was at home, stoking a fire in my fireplace, when the phone rang. My wife answered it and told me Johnny Evans was on the line. My heart sank, thinking that his call must mean there had been another murder of a young boy in Omaha. I was glad beyond words that the killer had been caught, that Johnny Evans's own crusade to bring him in had paid off at last, and that I had been able to contribute something valuable to the stopping of this one-man murder wave. Evans was particularly amazed that I had been able to predict that police or detective magazines would be found in the killer's residence. In his confession, Joubert said that he had used the detective magazines as part of his masturbatory rituals. Some of the unusual details Joubert revealed in this confession were that, after the first murder, he had gone to a McDonald's to wash off the blood, and then had eaten breakfast there. Later in the day, he had gone to a scout meeting where the abduction had been discussed, but he had not taken part in the conversation. He denied any sexual involvement with the boys, and even more vehemently denied that he had known them, stressing that he would not have done that sort of thing to any boy he knew, for instance, those in the scout troop. After both murders, however, he had gone back to his quarters and relived the details and masturbated. During this initial confession, Joubert also said that he had been certain after the incident at the daycare center that he would be picked up that day, and was glad that he had been apprehended, for he was sure that he would have killed again. The amount of interagency cooperation in this case was spectacular, and a model for the way things ought to be done in any major case involving an abduction and murder. Commendations for all the agencies involved were read into the congressional record, and congratulations were showered on the state, local, federal, and Air Force law enforcement entities who had contributed to catching this killer. I was proud to receive, from FBI Director William Webster, a letter of commendation about the profile I had drawn of the probable killer, which, the director wrote, pointed toward the apprehension of an individual fitting the physical and mental characteristics you described. Your assumptions of the subject were very accurate and displayed great skill. You have my profound thanks for a job well done. Of course, I wanted to learn more about Joubert, and so I followed the progress of his case through the courts. He initially pleaded not guilty, despite having given a confession, then revised that plea and pleaded guilty. A 3-judge panel gathered psychiatric and other reports, judged that he had been well aware of the nature of right and wrong at the time of the murders, and sentenced him to die in the electric chair. Various appeals resulted in a prolonged stay on death row. Joubert's background was traced quite carefully, and while most of it seemed quite ordinary on the surface, a build-up toward murder that had begun when Joubert was extremely young was evident. He was born in Massachusetts and grew up in Portland, Maine. One of the first fantasies he remembered was, at age 6 or 7, of coming up behind his babysitter, strangling her, and then eating her until she disappeared. Such a strange and violent fantasy at that age was unusual and provocative. Joubert had remembered and improved on it from then on, all during his childhood and adolescence, and up to and through the time of his murders. His mother had been a hospital worker and his father a counterman and waiter in a restaurant. They had separated because of marital difficulties at almost the same time as this first violent fantasy occurred to Joubert. They divorced when he was 10 and Joubert and his mother moved to Maine. He later told one psychiatrist, whose report was submitted to the court, that his mother had a short temper and would blow up and break things. He'd retreat to his room until the tantrum stopped, and she came in and apologized as she usually did. He also reported that his mother had belittled him and made him feel as if he was not a worthwhile person. She continued to spank him until he was 12, and had frequently disapproved of his open masturbation. His fantasies began with young women as their object, and then switched to young boys, adolescents in undershorts. Joubert did not know any longer whether the thoughts of strangling and stabbing these boys brought on the masturbation, or whether the masturbation brought on the thoughts. During his preteen years, Joubert became a pawn in the battle between his mother and father, as the latter tried to obtain custody of him but failed. To see his father during the summers, Joubert sometimes bicycled more than 100 miles on his own, and had also made a similar trip to see an uncle. To avoid going to a public high school that he thought too dangerous, Joubert took on a newspaper delivery route and used his earnings from it to pay the tuition at a Catholic high school, for which his mother would not or could not pay. He was tormented at the Catholic high school, he reported, because people thought he might be a homosexual. He took a girl to the senior prom, his only date during those years, to avoid being labeled as gay. He was on the track and cross-country teams. He was an avid Boy Scout, even delayed getting his final Eagle Scout badge for some time in order to continue on in the program as long as possible. In his yearbook he wrote, "Life is a highway with many roads branching off. Don't get lost." After graduating from high school, he had gone to a military college in Vermont, and the freedom he found there because of the lower drinking age in that state resulted in his not showing up for classes or in his sleeping through them, so his grade average was poor. When not drinking or sleeping, he played a great deal of the fantasy game Dungeons and Dragons. After a school year at this college, he returned home for a summer and then joined the Air Force. At his training school in Texas, he had made friends with one young man, and they had taken assignments together and roomed together at Offutt, beginning in the summer of 1983. It was then that Joubert had begun collecting his detective magazines. After a few weeks at Offutt, the roommate told Joubert that others on the base were referring to himself and Joubert as the girls. The allegation of homosexuality disturbed the roommate, and he abruptly moved out. This action provided a key pre-crime stress to Joubert. Less than a week after his friend moved out, Joubert abducted and murdered Danny Joe Eberle. He told his psychiatric interviewers that he had not really found out what it felt like to kill, and that while he was doing the killing, he was acting as if by rote, simply acting out the fantasy he had been perfecting since the age of